Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl.
Kia ora from Karen. It's my pleasure to be joined today for Books and Beyond by the poet Cirie Barford. Talofa, Cirie.
Malo, Karen. Good to see you again.
Here to hear you, along with our listeners. Cirie is a talented poet who's published three collections of poetry, Plea to the Spanish Lady, Glass Canisters, and Tapa Talk, and then most recently a collection of poetry and prose called Entangled Islands. Her work has appeared in many journals and anthologies, Essential New Zealand Poems, Landfall, Poetry New Zealand, and Writing the Pacific, to name just a few. In Cirie's case, the beyond part of our name, Books and Beyond, is particularly prescient in that Cirie is also a noted performance poet. She's performed with the group Pollination at events such as Going West Books and Writers Festival, the Brisbane Poetry Festival, and, of course, the annual Stars of Pacifica Poetry event, which I had the privilege of organizing for many years at Auckland Libraries. Cirie is of mixed Samoan and European descent, and she was born in West Auckland, right close to where we are today.
Yeah, that's right, West Auckland. And Te Aratu, which at that time, Te Aratu Peninsula, was very rural, like, you know, gravel roads, farms, so the city kind of grew outwards and joined up with us, caught us up.
And the city is continuing to grow. I understand there's become quite a, what do we call it? An enterprising to get into town.
Well, it's a bit of a dodgem race. Really.
Almost been re-ruralized, although it's a suburb. It's almost as if it's been re-ruralized. If you look at the difficulty,
And it's gentrifying, so that's sort of changing the whole nature of the community. Lots of implications there.
Yeah, I can imagine. So we're going to start today with my most recent encounter with Cirie, which was actually in the pages of the book, if we exclude the one at the library where you came in to get your lost umbrella. So I was preparing the Auckland Library's top 100 books of 2017 list at the end of last year, and I was leafing through a copy of Manifesto Aotearoa, 100 Political Poems, and was so pleased and gratified, knowing your poetry, to see that you were one of the writers included, Cirie. So this book was edited by Philip Temple and Emma Neal, and the publisher's blurb describes it like this. These writers, the 101 poets included in the book, these writers show that political poems can be the most vivid and eloquent calls for empathy, for action and revolution, and even for a simple calling to account. And thinking of your poetry, that made perfect sense to me, but how about you?
I think the way you live your life is a political act. The way you choose to act, react, not act, it is political whether you consider yourself a political person or not, because it's aligned to some sort of belief system. And so this poem is based on me going shopping at Countdown and seeing a woman selling chocos in a beaten up old pushchair with a baby on her back. And it was freezing and she was in jandals, and you could see that she actually probably needed the money from selling the fruit to buy bread or, you know, food.
First necessities.
Yeah. And I meant well and gave her money, but my... the way I did it didn't really empower her, because I didn't need the chocos, really. And I bought them and said, oh, look, I'll just take one, and then this is for your child. And another woman called me out on it and basically saluted this woman. And then I realized this woman, in her poverty, trying to feed her family, she was an urban activist. I mean, she was fighting for her family. It's kind of like a guerrilla warfare when things aren't set up so well in the country for a whole lot of people for various reasons. They can't access what they need to live well in a dignified fashion.
And every day is a battle.
Yeah. And at the same time, it was Anzac Day or Anzac Weekend, you know, and people are celebrating heroes. They're celebrating people who made sacrifices and died for country and family. And we often don't acknowledge the sacrifices people are making, particularly Indigenous people, but that people are making in our own country, in Aotearoa. So that's how this was born. I went back and thought, man, you know, I've just seen people celebrating, you know, people who fought for colonial masters, and here's a woman here trying to just fight for her family.
So you had the two images in your mind a spark. They rubbed together and
they
a spark.
Did. Yeah, juxtaposition. I love it when ideas and things, you know, there's a juxtaposition. Like, through contrast, things become clearer.
Mm, and a connection.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping you're going to read us.
I will. Okay, Papa de los Pobres. It's the morning after Anzac Day. Medals and politics have been aired with bugles, haka and stylized poppies marking distant shores, valour and loss. But there are still battles to be had in the suburbs, where the recession struck a hunchbacked woman in jandals, track pants and a budget rack floral parka. She's braked a pushchair chocker with chocos on the pavement outside Countdown. When I close in on her, I see she's fine-boned, that her misshapen back is actually a papoose slung beneath a mantle of synthetic flowers, and there are bald patches around the hood where tiny fists have plucked nylon fur to suck for warmth in the autumn wind. The woman holds a shard of corrugated card, her smile as shaky as the crayoned letter, $1 a choco. Her face is gentle, undemanding, but I have chocos galore at home, their wrinkled prickly flesh a green chorus with feijoas and fresh figs in a pottery bowl. And I need 4 gold coins for the special toothpaste guaranteed to soothe receded gums and nerves. The papoose whimpers. I pluck 2 fruit from the sagging canvas shelf, extract gold coins from my purse, smile then wince when the wind targets my mouth. This is for the chocos and these are for your child. She shakes her head. No. Takes 1 coin, presses the other back into my palm. I mean well, but I've got it all wrong. She lifts her chin. I left my island for a better life. Another woman approaches, scoops up chocos. Papa de los pobres, she exclaims. She sees a woman with empty cupboards who's taken to the streets to change things, stands to attention, salutes the urban activist.
Wow. Yeah, that really wanted to give a moment there. That's really love that. The act of how you present yourself to the world, as you were saying, is also a political act. Mm. I remember years ago we used to discuss the personal versus the political. And I think it's, especially in terms of women and the women's, from a women's point of view and a Pacific Island, certainly point of view in this poem of yours that I know is a point of view that is very important to you, and which leads us into the next question, which I wanted to ask you, which I wanted to move on to your most recent book, Entangled Islands. And entangled means many things in this book, and was a very interesting choice of title with a backstory. I thought you could tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Samoan concept of whātlawelawe, of you give goods and money on a regular basis. It's like a thing of reciprocity, and you receive back as well. And it's sort of like, it's got its pros and cons, you know, once you're in New Zealand and you're trying to balance things. Mm. There was an exhibition celebrating the war, in a way, or honouring the war at the Auckland Museum. And I went to see it, and it was called Entangled Islands. And when I walked into the room, there was this big photograph that had been blown up and put on the back wall, and it was my upa, my grandfather, as a prisoner of war as a child. So I walked into this room, and the first thing I saw was Count von Luckner and 2 small boys, and one of them was my grandfather, who was a prisoner of war in World War I on Motuihe Island. with my great-grandmother, who was Samoan Portuguese. So people with German names had been rounded up in the Pacific along with others, with Italian names and also some Jewish families like the Kronfelds, who I'm related to. And they were prisoners of war for the duration of the war, and their lands were confiscated, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So to go to the museum and see that, and that's when I changed the title of this book, which originally was going to be Disrupted Narratives, to Entangled Islands. Because we are entangled through colonialism, through family relationships, through our communities of belonging, in this particular area of the Southern Hemisphere.
Because I've noticed that it does explore a lot of this relationships between the... So a lot of it is, I'm going to say, autobiographical or inspired by real things that happened in your childhood, and especially wonderful portraits of some very strong women in your family. Also a very beautiful one about the factory work and your father. But particularly the Auntie Lucky, your aunt and your grandmother and your mother's portraits really stand out. So there's the relationships within a family, but also relationships within the two cultures. So Samoan on your mother's side and Palangi on your father's side. Mm-hmm. And then a third one that I distinguished was also a relationship between visible and invisible, in the sense of there are some magical elements, things that you might meet out when you're out alone unexpectedly.
Definitely. Because my Samoan grandmother, like my mother came to New Zealand in the 1950s, and she's from Lotofanga, so she spent some of her childhood in a village, and then because all their land was confiscated, they also were basically refugees on their own island. So my grandmother would come to New Zealand for 3 to 6 months every year, from when I was in primary school right up until she died when I was in my late 30s, early 40s. And she didn't speak great English, and we spoke a mixture of Samoan English and German at home. And she, of course, I mean, we'd have dinner and then we'd talk about aiko, about ghosts. It was natural. Well, I thought it was natural until friends would come around and they'd get freaked out. But it was just like natural for us. And it's natural for us to come to the table and do dream interpretation. And, you know, your ancestors are with you all the time. So when I went to school and then I realized this wasn't so, really, for a lot of people. And for some people it was bad. Mm-hmm. And remember that the Tohunga Suppression Act wasn't lifted until about 1963, which banned Māori people from doing their traditional healing, from passing on the esoteric knowledge. And so as Pacific Islanders, my family was also aware that you had to keep some of these things quiet. You had to not tell your Palangi friends in case they dobbed you in.
Oh.
So there was this element of fear. But in our home, in the safety of our home, all these, you know, talking with your ancestors, seeing them, completely natural.
It's interesting. So, you know, these schoolmates were probably seeing Casper the Friendly Ghost on television, but it had been made very clear that what was on television was, in fact, fiction. And it's that dichotomy, the fact and fiction, which European civilization has made such a, not always, because if you go back far enough in time, but in, say, since the Industrial Revolution, has made such a clear break between, which perhaps misses out on a lot of the fertile inspiration that comes from keeping these things alive and around you.
It's a cultural construct.
Yeah.
What is fact and what is fiction is a cultural construct. So I'm on Facebook, and I just, I've got a lot of friends and on Facebook, and we've been in Wananga together. So I've actually explored the spirits of this land through Māori Mataoranga knowledge base. Mm-hmm. So when I go into a library and I see the Dewey decimal classification system, it's actually meaningless to me.
Yes, as to a lot of people, yeah. Mm,
mm, mm. So because that's part of my life, I do write about it, but selectively. Some stories are not to be told. They're to be guarded and handed down through your bloodline. And there's a lot of stories I know that were shared to me from people from other cultures. They're not my stories to tell.
Mm. Did you feel writing this book, because there's a lot of stories where, thinking back on Manifesto Aotearoa, where you are quite rebellious, so the hairdresser who wants to cut your hair very short so it won't look too Pacific Islander, and you just want to run away, let it grow.
Yeah.
There were others, you know, the reaction against being told not to speak Samoan, that's more of a coming of age realization, not when you were very small, perhaps, and your mother.
Well, New Zealand in the 1960s was so much different than now. Like, privilege came with looking and being Pākehā and living a Pākehā life. So I grew up in a neighbourhood where there was black power, where a lot of the ladies in my neighbourhood had gone to, like, native schools. And the thing was that Mum wasn't allowed to speak her languages in Samoa growing up. She couldn't speak German. It was too dangerous. She couldn't speak Samoan. She didn't speak English. Didn't start learning English till she was 8 or 9. And so all around me, I heard Samoan, but people stopped me speaking it, because the idea was you're safer if you only speak English, because that's where the power is. And they're the powerful people. So if you only speak English, and because I'm born and I look quite fair, so like I've got blue eyes and quite fair skin. I mean, I look Samoan and sepia, put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, take a black and white photo or a sepia photo, you can sort of see from my features that I have Polynesian heritage.
Yes.
And so I could pass, whereas some of my cousins who had the same background as me were brown-eyed and olive skin, so I could pass. So I was very aware of the privilege that this brought in terms of not being bullied and all sorts of stuff, but also the opposite side, that I felt left out and I felt that I didn't look like the people that I identified with, and that's carried right on through to my adulthood because my subject matter is not Pālangi enough to be included in a lot of lineups.
Mainstream, what we've called mainstream,
And so I'm classified as a Pacifica poet, but there'll be like photo shoots and sometimes I'll be there with the group with my Pacifica poet friends that I read with, but I might be cropped out in the final photo.
Oh no.
Yeah, because like I'm too fair and people want a Pacifica representation, like with people who look brown.
Yeah.
But I know that I know my ancestry and I know everything, but it's like, so I'm still walking that tightrope, you know, and you just have to navigate your own space and like, oh, well, you know, this is it.
Yeah. I think it's something that you come across also in a number of our Pacifica poetry events. Like Doug Poole talks about this as well. The number of Afakasi poets feel this, well, it's an entanglement, isn't it, in some ways?
He's my cousin, by the way.
Oh, is he? I didn't realize.
Well, you know, Whatsamoa, like, our great-grandmothers were sisters.
Yeah.
You know? and I'm having dinner with him and Penny next Friday with Sia Figel, who's a Samoan novelist.
Yes.
Who's sort of had her own battles about this kind of thing.
Yeah. It's interesting because I didn't come to New Zealand in 2000, so I don't have a clear... Although, I have to say, probably even if I was here myself, recent European immigrant from Europe, if not European, would probably not have had the perception to see these things happening around me nonetheless as I walk through the streets. But the interesting thing for me that you're pointing, that you're bringing to my attention is this need on the part of the parents, the power, the use of the word power that you gave me there. So having your children speak English was not one of those enhancements like today's parents, mainstream parents, want their children to have, you know, the piano lesson because that will get them into college better. They want to have the special tutoring for the exams. It was actually a question of survival and of power. It was much more dramatic and essential.
Well, my mum identifies as German Samoan, but like, you know, she's German Jew. So there was a strong sense, and when my family was interned on Motuhi Island, and then my grandfather again in World War II, because they got shipped back to Germany, and they were South Sea Islanders, and they came back to the Pacific, and then World War II happened, and, you know, surname, German name, they get rounded up again, you know, so, which broke him, actually, second time round. Anyway, that's another story. So, like, there was a whole thing about being aware that you can be identified by your language and your heritage.
Yeah. There was a piece in Entangled Islands. There's a specific mention of the power of language, which I really loved. You might be able to tell the story better than I. The one about Miss Archer, about your mum and Miss Archer at school. Mm. It's just this little paragraph right here. I marked it because I'm very interested in language and how it shapes identity and the change of languages, having changed languages myself a couple of times.
Yeah, so my mum has green eyes and like sort of olive skin and like Polynesian hair, and I have her Polynesian hair, you know. And so mum tried to be a good Palangi wife because dad's family wasn't so happy with the marriage.
Mm.
And so this teacher at school picked on my sister, and mum went into bat. And mum used to sleep with hair curlers to try and like put her hair so it wasn't frizzy, but just gentle waves. Miss Archer tried to wriggle away, but mum had spent years sleeping on spiky hair curlers, so she wasn't going to be put off by one squishy teacher. It was an incredible face-off between two women who understood the power of language, one of whom was imprinting the pain of a miserable childhood onto a student who seemed to have everything that she'd been denied as a girl. Miss Archer dissolved into tears just as the bell rang for class. Mum hugged the defeated teacher and dried her stricken blue eyes with an embroidered hanky. Yes, so the whole thing about hair, because my hair was razor cut and I was forcibly held down and had my Afro-ish kind of hair...
tamed.
Cut off.
Yeah.
In Samoan culture, that's how you punish a girl.
Oh.
You cut her hair, often publicly, it's a way to shame them. So, yeah. Like, I was, to me, shamed all the time, whereas my sister had straight hair. Her hair was deliberately curled into Victorian curls with rags.
Oh, yeah.
So there was an acceptability of curl. There was the European curl and the Polynesian curl. So you were really aware of this in the 1960s. There was no such word as Pacifica.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It didn't exist.
Yeah. In fact, there's a current that runs through the book. For me, was the incomprehension on the part of a child for these societal constructs and the gradual becoming aware of them and how it was explained by the elders and differently by various elders, and the children do accept. Confusion, you know, they accept being told what the way through the confusion is, but at the same time I could see a definitely rebellious soul in there sometimes asking, you know, why.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to ask also about, I wanted to ask you to read a poem from you, a poem that you've chosen to read from Entangled Islands, apart from my favorite passage about your mother standing down the mean school teacher.
Shall I do that one about... There's Flying Fox and Che Guevara.
That would be lovely. One of my favorites.
So this is from, I spent, 7 years going backwards and forwards and living in various villages in Kanaki, New Caledonia, and the Loyalty Islands. And the people there are struggling for their own voice and to keep their own voice, really, the indigenous people. The Flying Fox and Che Guevara. I cared for my children like a flying fox. Kept them safe under my wings when they were small and hesitant. Tipped paracetamol and antibiotics down persistently in inflamed throats during endless nights of earache. Gassed them with Ventolin cocktails when asthma stole their breath. Had broken bones reset and a tongue bitten off by a faulty landing on a trampoline. Reattached in a theatre without movies. Then regretted it when that fearful mouth started up again. We've laughed at dinosaurs and cartoons, at Nana crooning Buffalo Soldier, at Pa's jokes and the bills that kept arriving for the ever-declining cash flow card. There were the retreads that outlived cars and the unexpected appearance of food in our sprayed and wiped out cupboards. There's so much to think about as I sit barefoot in church, behind the vividly turbaned mamas, paying their respects to Eloi Machoro, a South Pacific Che Guevara, a dead son of this island. That siege and the photo of Machoro smashing a ballot box with an axe immortalized him beyond the bullets that felled a man into a crimson pool. My sons are still learning the difference between people's needs and wants and how to match actions with words. But I remember they wore their Che Guevara t-shirts until they fell off their backs.
I'd like to clap. I'm afraid it's
It's hard to do that standing still because I usually do that as a performance poet. I did it in Wellington for the festival a couple of weeks ago. And you're moving, so it's hard to
with
do
with the
it
rhythm. You're still picking up the rhythm with your body. Yeah.
Thank you, Karen.
Oh, that's such a lovely poem. So interesting that the poem also refers to words, actions, the spaces between things. And I know that you've said that right around the time, not sure if it was right around the time of Tapa Talk and of your visits to New Caledonia, that you'd become interested in exploring the universe through this concept of the space that is separation, but it's also a relation. Can you tell me?
In Pacifica, Polynesian way, there's no such thing as empty space. So even when you do tapa or siapo, as you would say in Samoan, you've got tusili'i, the fine lines. Everything is connected. And so there's a whole lot of literature coming out now called Tava, which is time-space theory. And so there's a lot of literature and a lot of storytelling going on now, bringing back, before it's all lost, indigenous Polynesian concepts of time and space.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And that's something that I've been exploring. So we're talking about Stephen Hawking, you mentioned the event horizon. Well, when I think of the event horizon, I understand scientifically what it is, but then I am immediately related to myths and legends. I immediately put it within a different framework. And so for me, the myths and legends, they are encodings of truth. So some of the old Polynesian story songs that children sang actually had constellations, like stargazing was put into it. Like the words sound like quite simple, but it's actually just like you use knots and knotting and other things. It's the way you actually encode celestial knowledge. So that's something I'm interested in at the moment.
Yeah, and so we've just got a couple minutes more, but what are you doing at the moment? Tell us about that.
I'm working on a collection called Piula Blue, and it's based on my late partner who actually committed suicide, and it's been a year since he's gone. And so in order to honour him, and to help that passage from grief into Te Ao Marama, into the world of light, I've been writing a sequence of poems, which I've been performing and had some really encouraging feedback. And on the basis of this collection, I got a Pacifica residency at the Michael King Centre for the end of this year. Yeah, it's meant to be joyful. It's not meant to be doom and gloom, but I'm exploring grief and loss and moving through into new way of living. But I'm trying to do it from a more Pacifica perspective, using cultural frameworks and ideas to explore that loss and moving through. And I've got another project on the boil. It's going to be like a winter project with Michaela Curtis. So Michaela does the very old-fashioned printing when you take the lead letters, one by one, and you have to assemble them. And she's got she uses the old printing presses that are at Motet. And some of them, I think, go back to the missionary time. The missionaries brought out to Aotearoa. So what she's doing now is she's using those presses to publish Pacifica Voice and Other Voice, and we'll be looking at pictures. I take a lot of photographs, and we'll be doing photographs that I've taken, and we'll be doing an e-zine. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, e-zine.
And we'll be doing that, so because it's too expensive to publish on paper. So we'll be taking a lot of my photography and then writing flash fictional poetry to go with it. So
Fantastic, something to watch for. We'll be following you with pleasure. Thanks so much, Siri, for having come on our show today.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed it. Bye. Bye. Bye.